You're listening to the free, ad-supported version of Truth News Radio Australia. If you're already a subscriber to Truth News Radio, you can access our ad-free content by logging into your member account at truthnews.com.au and going to the subscribers area, which you'll find under the member menu. If you're not a subscriber, you're most welcome to access our free content, but I encourage you to become a subscriber. We have several options available, including a concession option for those who can't afford the full year subscription price. For those who do subscribe for a full year, we offer the unique TNRA t-shirt and a resource DVD, which we'll send to you simply for the price of postage. Thanks for listening to Truth News, and we now return you to the show. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Well, in the second hour of my show today, I'm very pleased to bring you Craig Isherwood, Secretary of the Citizens Electoral Council, and a man who's been on the show many times in the past, and we've had quite a few interesting discussions about world events and the unfolding global economy, which is something that I really want to today. I've got some burning questions that I want to ask Craig, so just welcome to the show, Craig Isherwood. Are you there?
Yes, thanks, Harold. It's good to be back again. It's been a while, but I'm here. Yep.
Indeed. It has been too long. And Craig, perhaps you could begin by telling us a little about the conference that you recently had there in Melbourne. I was just having a look at your website. Looks like it was quite a big lineup.
Yes, it was one of the biggest events that we've ever done. We've only done two international conferences in our organisation. The first was in 1993. And this one was this last weekend, where we had a range of international speakers on the subject of the world land bridge, peace on earth, goodwill towards all men, which is a bit of a theme on Easter.
Sure.
But the point is that what you have in the world today is two distinct political economic movements. The first, on the one hand, you've got the existing IMF, World Bank, collapsing transatlantic system, which is centered on all the collapsing countries of Europe and the huge debt-related bubble of the, what we've seen, the global financial crisis. And on the other hand, you have this grouping of countries called the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
Yeah.
Now, this new grouping has come about, particularly since the global financial crisis, to deal with establishing a new model based on a new just world economic order around large-scale infrastructure and development and national sovereignty. So this is a huge a huge new development in the world in the last period, particularly in the last 18 months. It's really got somewhat of a head of steam. And our conference was themed around the idea that Australia should join this new world order, this BRICS grouping of countries. Now, physically, that's not possible because the BRICS countries are the founding countries, but the principles of what they stand for are absolutely phenomenal. And our conference brought a very special guest, Professor Gheorghe Tolarea, who is the executive director for the National Committee on BRICS Research in Russia. And this come in June, July, there's going to be the next BRICS meeting held at UFA in Russia at the same time as the SCO meeting,
okay.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting. So what you're getting here is a complete realignment of a lot of countries. They're saying, look, we don't want to go with this collapsing transatlantic system. We don't want to go with IMF and World Bank austerity. And we want to go with this new idea of a collaborative partnership approach with Russia, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa for the purpose of developing our nation. And this has really, really put a thorn in the side of the British-backed and Obama-backed IMF system. You see recently that you've got the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Now, this is centered around This is one of China's initiatives, but a lot of countries have now joined that as founding members. And Australia sort of has just signed a memorandum of understanding to reach agreement to join as a founding member. They haven't joined yet, but this is in complete opposition to the threats and arm twisting made by Obama last year around the G20, because Australia's natural trading partner, the biggest trading partner, we're in this region, the Pacific region, the Asia-Pacific region, would be to join the AIIB bank. But Obama said, no, you shouldn't. And at that particular point, we hesitated and pulled back. I mean, it was a real threat by Obama. And he's been left cold now because England, the United Kingdom, a whole heap of European countries have now joined the AIIB bank. Now, this bank is designed with startup capital of $50 billion. It might increase to $100 billion now, but it's specifically for large-scale infrastructure development projects without the conditionalities that come with the IMF and the World Bank. So, I mean, there's certain conditions involved, but they're not the same type of conditions. They're built around the idea of a country's developing itself in a sovereign way. And consequently, there's a great deal of optimism now coming from many countries. I don't know how much your listeners have followed what's taken place in Egypt. Now, Egypt's not part of the BRICS grouping, but there is all sorts of collaboration going on in the background. But the important thing is that here you had El-Sisi come in. He decided to build the second Suez Canal instead of going to the IMF and the World Bank and saying, please give us the money to do this. They actually raised the fund from a sovereign debt issue, which was completely oversubscribed in a very, very short period of time. Something like $20 billion was raised.
Right.
But they've got in and employed, well, the word went out, we want to employ all unemployed people in Egypt so there's jobs for everyone. Now, that's actually taken place. They've almost actually finished building the thing, the canal, in a very, very short period of time.
So this was funded by the BRICS Development Fund, is that right?
No, this was funded internally using their own internal credit. What they did was, and any country can do this, Harrowood, is that they say, we want to fund this
through
the latent savings of the population. So therefore, we'll issue debt certificates backed by the assets of the nation. That is, but we will raise these funds in forms of debt certificates just from the people. So the people own the project, as opposed to the IMF and the World Bank that say we have, partial ownership of this project.
That is a really different model, isn't it? And it's one that makes a lot of sense. Are there any projects in our history? I mean, I'm thinking about like the Snowy Mountain scheme. Did we fund any projects in a similar way in Australia?
Well, we actually we did in two different ways. Now, on the website, on our website, which is at www.cecaust.com, at the top of it, you'll see there's 2015 conference, and my presentation's not up there yet. But I went through, Harrowood, the history of the Commonwealth Bank.
Yeah.
And our Commonwealth Bank was established in 1911. By the Labor Party in response to the Great Depression of the 1893 period, where you saw a huge number of banks literally close their doors and hundreds of millions of pounds millions of pounds of depositors' money just get gobbled up and lost by the banks. And this was coming out of a land boom of the 1890s.
Right.
Now, because a lot of ordinary workers lost their money, there was a huge call for a state-owned or government-owned bank that would protect the workers' money. So the Labor Party in 1893 had in its platform for the next 60 years the formation of a national bank. That came to fruition in 1911 with King O'Malley, who pushed it through. Fisher at that time didn't want it. But the Commonwealth Bank then set about actually funding a huge number of different projects by literally saying to the people of Australia, and Denison Miller did this as the first governor, he said, this bank is backed by the assets and the wealth of the nation, and I'll do whatever's necessary to develop the nation using these assets. So he took in deposits from as a savings bank, and using those deposits, he then, and the power that he was given as a national bank, began to coordinate the internal credit of Australia. very quickly, and to give you some sense of what he did, you know, the Melbourne Board of Works in 1913 wanted to get a loan to build infrastructure, you know, normal public works. So they used to go to London a lot. And when they went to London, London said, oh, no, we'll only give you £1 million at 4.5%. When Denison Miller was approached by the Victorian government or the Victorian Local Municipal Association, he said, well, I'll give you £3 million at 4%. And they were rather surprised about how the heck can this new bank do this? And Denison Miller simply said, well, my bank is backed by the assets of the nation. Now, that's the sort of, with banking, it's got to do, 90% of banking, maybe 100% of banking has got to do with confidence. If you have a confident system, or people have confidence in their banking system, you can do an enormous amount. But as soon as you lose that confidence, you end up with runs in the bank and the system will collapse. So the Commonwealth Bank went forward as a government bank and literally coordinated the funding of World War One. It brought all the private banks into line, you might say. It issued war bonds in order to be able to fund the war. It coordinated the up to the tune of, at that time, £458 million to create the wheat pools, the wool pools, rabbit pools, and all sorts of produce pools for the purposes of protecting the primary producer. And it was meat, butter, cheese, rabbits, sugar, jam, and fruit pools to a staggering total of £458 million during the course of the war. Another example of what the bank did, it was able to help the government support the Commonwealth steamship lines. During the war, the British-backed shipping lines forced the price of shipping up from about $4.75 per ton to $10.50. In fact, there's one example that was read out in Parliament where the value of a cargo, a shipment of maize, was £18,826. The freight was £50,433. So at that time, the Deputy Prime Minister Hughes was in London. He saw that there was 15 cargo vessels for sale. So what he did was he rung up his treasurer, Hughes, W.M. Hughes, who then contacted Miller from the bank and said, I need $2 million to draw out tomorrow to buy these ships, because if I don't do it quick, the shipping line, the ships will be bought up, or you know, the deal will be shut down by the other private shippers. The money was in the Commonwealth Bank. Next day, the deal was clinched, and therefore we ended up with the Commonwealth steamship lines, which after the confiscation of another about 21 ships from the war, ended up providing us with a very profitable shipping line here in this country. That's what that bank did. Now, this was simply an overdraft. But
yeah,
time and time again, you come back to this principle of a bank providing the ability to mobilise the internal credit of the nation, and that's what a national bank can do. In World War II, we did the same thing. When Chifley and Curtin came back in, I mean, there was nothing spent in that previous period during the Great Depression to alleviate the deflation that was in the economy. And deflation means that prices fall because people are trying to sell their goods to people who don't have jobs, and that causes more unemployment, it causes lack of demand, and you can't create the jobs necessary to keep people in work because you can't replace industry inventories and so forth. The way you deal with this is counterintuitive to the private banking system. You need a government to create the credit and spend that into the economy, the physical economy, the productive economy, not the speculative side that we have today, but actually build industry, build the necessary industry to produce goods, put people back into work, and then stimulate demand. Now, for the 12 years before the war, there was only about £2.3 million created above the normal amount that was above normal government expenditure, because there was nothing being spent, no credit being raised for the economy. However, when it came time to war, as it happens with war, the financial taps were turned on, and the Commonwealth Bank, through the issuance of Treasury, the government buying.
We are just going to break, sorry to interrupt. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, speaking to Craig Isherwood about the banking system in Australia. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Through Through advances in technology, our lives have greatly improved, except in the area of nutrition. People feed their pets better than they feed themselves, and it's time we changed all that. Our primary defense against aging and disease in this toxic environment is good nutrition. In a world where natural foods have been irradiated, adulterated, and mutilated, Youngevity can provide the nutrients you need. Logos Radio Network gets many requests to endorse all sorts of products, most of which we reject. We have come to trust Youngevity so much, we became a marketing distributor along with Alex Jones, Ben Fuchs, and many others. When you order from LogosRadioNetwork.com, your health will improve as you help support quality radio. As you realize the benefits of Youngevity, you may want to join us. As a distributor, you can experience improved health, help your friends and family, and increase your income. Order now.
Are you being harassed by debt collectors with phone calls, letters, or even lawsuits? Stop debt collectors now with the Michael Maris Proven Method. Michael Maris has won 6 cases in federal court against debt collectors, and now you can win too. You'll get step-by-step instructions in plain English on how to win in court using federal civil rights statutes, what to do when contacted by phone, mail, or court summons, how to answer letters and phone calls, how to get debt collectors out of your credit report, how to turn the financial tables on them and make them pay you to go away. The Michael Maris Proven Method is the solution for how to stop debt collectors. Personal consultation is available as well. For more information, please visit ruleoflawradio.com and click on the blue Michael Maris banner or email michaelmaris@yahoo.com. That's ruleoflawradio.com or email michaelmiras@yahoo.com to learn how to stop debt collectors now.
Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Herewood Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to Craig Isherwood, and we're talking a bit about the history of the banking industry in Australia. And Craig, I don't want to break your chain of thought because it's very interesting what you're saying, but I do have just something I feel I need to interject at this point, because we're talking a lot about World War One and World War Two, and you know, World War One particularly was such a disaster for the Australian people. I mean, something like, you know, 20% of all the men in the country died, and it was such an unnecessary war for everyone except the those who profited from it. I understand that the operation of the Commonwealth Bank in some aspects is preferable to what we're seeing today, but the fact that this all took place just before the First World War also gives me concern, because what I see there is that the bank, like all the banks around the world, used the war as a profit making engine.
Well, I think the point though was that Australia was part of the imperial government. It's part of the British Empire at that point.
Yeah.
And the original hoopla of the war meant that Australia's economy was going to get dragged into a war economy. And the fact is that the Commonwealth Bank was able to save Australia from the depressive effects of what was going to take place anyway. We didn't create that war. That war was created by the British Empire, by the British themselves,
yeah,
and we got sucked into it. And without the Commonwealth Bank doing what it did, we would be absolutely destroyed as a nation. It didn't profit for the purposes of private gain. That's the difference here.
Okay.
It developed what was necessary to fund the war and expand our physical economy. Of course, you know, the wars are disgusting. The World War II, the same thing. However, if we hadn't mobilized in World War II, our productive sector, then we wouldn't have been able to defend ourselves. And we actually made a net contribution to World War II in the Lend-Lease program because of what was done. Now, you don't have a choice. When you get dragged into a war, and I wish Australia wasn't involved in World War II, but of course we had the specific aspect of it, you've got to defend yourself. And you can't rely on the private banking system to do that. You need to have actually a government bank that acts at the direction of the government to prosecute the war. Look, see, the difference between a national bank, Harrowwood, and a private banking system is quite substantial. And Chifley recognised this in the Labor government, where he said, what you have at the private bank is a bunch of private directors, private shareholders that are only looking for maximised profit. However, they will take the actions necessary to preserve and protect that profit. This is not necessarily going to be the best for the nation as a whole. And in the case of the Depression, the Commonwealth Bank could have acted to create the credit to internally stimulate the economy such that we did not have a depression.
Okay.
But it willfully and politically chose to because it was under the control of the London bankers. We've only had two periods of history where we've actually had a functional Commonwealth Bank, and that was during World War I when it first started under Dennis and Miller, and then under World War II up until the death of Chifley, and that's it. We've never had one since then because the private banking system simply smashed it. But in terms of creating the credit or using a national bank as a principle for the internal development of the economy, you can see what can be done.
Can I just ask, Craig, because I'm trying to understand this also from a modern perspective, because how does that compare with, for example, the measures that Kevin Rudd brought in after the GFC in 2008, which were supposedly an economic stimulus program? How does that compare with the system you're talking about? Because they're somewhat similar on one level, but I think you're going to say they're quite different.
Well, I'm going to say they're quite different because that system is to prop up the banks first and foremost, Harrowwood.
Yeah.
The system itself, the financial and monetary system, was in the process of disintegration. The system was disintegrating.
Yeah.
The economies still are there, and you have to support the economies in a real way. Now, building school halls and so forth is not the same as spending money to put many people into longer-serving jobs around large infrastructure projects that continue to create jobs into the future, railway systems, high-speed rail systems that increase the efficiency of the economy, water projects to deal with drought so that you can irrigate more land, nuclear power stations in order to create through fusion or fission energies, it doesn't really matter, to create cheap power. These sorts of projects create longer-term jobs than just once you build a school hall, what happens to the construction workers? They've disappeared. You haven't increased the capacity of the economy to employ people. And that was not done for the purposes of developing the physical economy. It was done to protect the then-collapsing banking system by injecting a large amount of money into the system at that point. And that's the difference, is that the Kevin Rudd stimulus program was to prop up the banks, which were in the process of disintegration and actually potentially closing their doors.
Okay, yeah, interesting, yeah. To continue.
I just wanted to make the point. In today's system, what we're talking about with this change with the BRICS is to develop new financial institutions that use the power of the state to develop large infrastructure projects that employ many, many tens of thousands of people in their countries that have long-term economic benefits for the increasing standard of living for their peoples. But it's done on the basis of sovereign economic development within sovereign nation states. Now, the previous system, like under the World Bank and the IMF, they are promoting the New World Order, which is run through supranational organizations, things like the organizations, not so much like the United Nations, but the TPP ideas, right? Trans-Pacific Partnership, where you have multinational corporations with the power to sue governments that are trying to make decisions in the interest of their people. These sorts of supranational organisations or groupings that destroy national sovereignty also feed into the policy of world overpopulation, and that the world's population has reduced, for example, from the likes of Prince Philip, who said it, and the royal family have said it very openly, the world's population has got to be reduced from the 7.1 billion people we have now down to below 1 billion. Schellenhuber from Germany was knighted by the Queen for that particular policy. So when you've got that policy with inside the British financial and monetary system, the transatlantic system, which is collapsing, you're not going to get a commitment for large-scale infrastructure projects to develop the capacity for people, for countries to support their peoples, which is why this example I gave before of Egypt developing its infrastructure in a sovereign way by issuing these debt certificates from within the country would be a classic modern example. We have over $1 trillion tied up in superannuation funds today, Harold. A lot of that's in the speculative market. A lot of it's in the stock market, which is overinflated. What if that money was to be mobilised, the $1 trillion in superannuation funds was to be mobilised to build large-scale infrastructure development projects here in Australia? For example, a high-speed magnetic levitation train system that runs inside the states of Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, up through to Darwin, and then down through to Western Australia, and then across again, so that you cut the tyranny of distance. You'd use the car manufacturing plants, retool them to build a rolling stock for these sorts of things. How many high-paid jobs could you create by mobilising that credit, or to build more dam systems or pipelines to shift water around? To develop other industries and towns inside the country. All that money, the issue is not money. The issue is how do you mobilise the physical economy of the nation? How do you mobilise the credit? Unfortunately, many people are used to getting huge returns on their investments, like 10, 12%, and they think that somehow that is a normal. Well, that's actually usury, and you have to expect a return of between 3 and 5%. If you intend to support the physical economy of your nation. And that's actually what historically has always been the case.
Absolutely. And we are just going to break. But when we come back from break, Craig, I want to actually talk about what's happening in Australia right now. And I want to see if we can have some predictions. We have to try and anticipate what's going to happen. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The notorious serial killer Arsenic Annie used rat poison to do in her family. You're no Arsenic Annie, but you may be serving your own family a deadly poison every day. I'm Dr. Catherine Albrecht. Details in a moment.
Google is watching you, recording everything you've ever searched for and creating a massive database of your personal information. That's creepy. But it doesn't have to be that way. Startpage.com is the world's most private search engine. Startpage.com doesn't store your IP address, make a record of your searches, or use tracking cookies, and they're third-party certified. If you don't like Big Brother spying on you, start over with Startpage. Great search results and total privacy. Startpage.com, the world's most private search engine.
It's hydrogenated oil, and it kills 50,000 people a year. It's made by attaching hydrogen atoms to liquid oils to make them creamy and solid at room temperature. But that process creates a toxic substance that damages brain and nerve cells. It's so poisonous, the National Academy of Sciences says no one should eat it. These so-called trans fats double your risk of heart attack, disrupt liver function, and increase your risk of diabetes, prostate, and breast cancer. Today, Arsenic Annie could kill her family slowly with margarine, coffee creamer, cookies, and pie crusts. So be sure to read the label and eliminate everything that says hydrogenated from your diet. This is Dr. Catherine Albrecht. More news and information at CatherineAlbrecht.com.
Did Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
Rule of Law Radio is proud to offer the Rule of Law Traffic Seminar. In today's America, we live in an us-against-them society, and if we, the people, are ever going to have a free society, then we're going to have to stand and defend our own rights. Among those rights are the right to travel freely from place to place, the right to act in our own private capacity, and most importantly, the right to due process of law. Traffic courts afford us the least expensive opportunity to learn how to enforce and preserve our rights through due process. Former Sheriff's Deputy Eddie Craig, in conjunction with Rule of Law Radio, has put together the most comprehensive teaching tool available that will help you understand what due process is and how to hold courts to the rule of law. You can get your own copy of this invaluable material by going to ruleoflawradio.com and ordering your copy today. By ordering now, you'll receive a copy of Eddie's book, The Texas Transportation Code, The Law Versus the Lie, video and audio of the original 2009 seminar, hundreds of research documents, and other useful resource material. Learn how to fight for your rights with the help of this material from ruleoflawradio.com. Order your copy today, and together we can have the free society we all want and deserve.
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking today to Craig Isherwood, Secretary of the Citizens Electoral Council, political party in Australia, based on some of the principles of the founding governments of Australia, like the Chifley government, which brought in a lot of good, solid policies, and very, very keen on the sovereignty of the people and not basically selling out your birthright to foreign powers and foreign ownership. Now, Craig, I would want to have time today to talk a little about the current situation, the current world situation, and the current situation in Australia, because we have a situation now where it seems that we're in a very, very unstable period, with the indicators looking a little bit like the lead-up to the GFC in 2008. We have a surging US dollar, and we have a plummeting oil price. And those two indicators were also in the lead-up to what happened in 2008. We have a very volatile Australian currency, which seems to... to me, that just, like, that's instability, and it's very hard to run a business or plan for the future if your currency is sort of wobbling all over the place, as Australia's currency does. But we're also seeing other major currencies really plummeting in relation to the US dollar. But we're not really seeing the US economy looking that good either. It seems to be that European nations, by negative interest rates, have propped up the US currency. What I want to do is to try and anticipate what the likely scenarios are, particularly for Australia, in the coming next couple of years. I mean, I'll just leave it with you, but I really want to get some handle on, we have to at least try to anticipate the future. I know we'll probably get it wrong, but we have to try, don't you think?
I think you have to look at it top down, Howard,
yeah.
Because the problem is the global financial crisis of 2007 has never been solved. In fact, it's got worse. The too-big-to-fail banks have got 40% bigger. The derivatives bubble, which is made up, these are speculative instruments used by the banks to so-called hedge their positions, but they're totally speculative. These have got bigger. I mean, Australia's derivatives bubble's gone from about $17 trillion of derivatives to now $23 trillion. In that same period, these derivatives are simply nothing more than gambling side bets, which is the best way to understand them. That's what's driving the problems within the system. So what you're getting globally is massive instability, and the countries like Greece, for example, that people hear about from time to time in the media, they've been smashed by austerity, have been smashed by austerity up until the new government has just come around and saying, we're not going to go with this policy anymore. We want to go with a debt conference. We want to restructure the debt so that we don't, because we can't pay it. And this debt that's in the world today is totally unpayable. So then you come back to Australia and you see this, what I see is a phenomenon of one-term governments. And I think this is freaking Tony Abbott out a fair bit too. Now, it didn't happen in New South Wales, but they're going with now the privatisation of the electricity grid, which is exactly the same policies, both in Victoria and in Queensland, that saw governments thrown out after one term. Now, you saw the austerity measures that Hockey was trying to bring in health with the surcharge, the $20 GP surcharge, then was reduced to $5. Debate, right, all of this austerity is to try and balance the budget because of the fact that our economy is collapsing. The commodity prices have gone through the floor. I mean, you know, I think I was looking at iron ore prices, I think $49 a ton now, something like that, to China, because China has a huge stockpile of these resources. Now, the problem is that if you try to balance the budget all the time in a shrinking economy, you're going to end up with having to enforce austerity. And that means that possibly we're looking at a one-term Abbott government as well, simply because these policies don't work. They're driven by the global speculative bubble of having to make huge corporate profits, huge profits all the time at the expense of the people. And this is the nature of the private banking system internationally. So this is where, again, I come back to the BRICS. The BRICS are counterpositioning themselves to say, we can't go with this policy. We don't want to end up like Greece. We want an alternative. Therefore, there's a new collaborative partnership taking place amongst these nations, which is built around real economic development, not funding the banks, but actually really developing railway systems, dams, pipelines, energy, and so forth. Here in Australia, we have no high-speed rail. Yet last December, China announced another 3,000 kilometres of high-speed rail. Kenya has got high-speed rail, but we don't have it. I mean,
it's African shocking, countries. Isn't it? I mean, it really is shocking. And in a city like Sydney, that's where I live, the lack of a good quality rail system is just so damaging to the quality of life. It is such a glaring problem in Sydney, and also around Australia too, but it's just incredible to me. It really is.
Well, this is a mentality that's I think up until the late 80s, I think you had two premiers that really stuck out, and that was Premier Cord in West Australia and Premier Joe Bjelke-Petersen up in Queensland. Now, these guys were called the developmentalists. That was the end. They were the end, you might say, of the period of where governments actually committed themselves to building real large-scale infrastructure development projects. Now, I know people say Joby was corrupt and all this sort of stuff. I don't have any evidence of that, but I do know that he built many power stations, dams, roads, opened up new mining opportunities for coal, and actually that's what Queensland profited from for the many, many years, the 19 years that he was Premier. So Charles Court in Western Australia, the same thing. These guys actually developed or used their positions to physically develop the economy by physically developing real infrastructure to provide water and so forth. Now, that's all finished. That stopped. That stopped in the 1990s with the development of this orientation towards wealth actually means speculation. So you saw the Allen bonds begin to rise. You saw the development of the takedown of what we call the Bretton Woods system was part of this, but the destruction of the Glass-Steagall banking reforms that were in place since 1933. Now, these banking reforms meant that you couldn't have banks like merchant banks and investment banks merging with commercial banks, which are your savings banks and your trading banks. Therefore, these banks were completely separate. There were laws to stop that from happening. And in the 1990s, those laws started to get weakened until about 96 when Clinton in the US repealed Glass-Steagall. Therefore, you had the build-up of these big, too-big-to-fail banks. Now, we've got five of them or four of them here plus Macquarie Bank that are far too big to fail. And there's no mechanisms inside the Australian economy to deal with these things if any one of these four Australian banks fail. Then the point being is that our banking system shifted from being one that was highly regulated to one that's now highly speculative. And that puts us at the beck and call of whatever takes place in the global system, because Australia's debt has a huge amount of external debt, which is tied to the European and other banks, and their future is what is going to determine what happens inside Australia. We could do what was done and has been done before, of using the superannuation funds by issuing sovereign debt bonds in Australia at 2 or 3% interest, backed by the nation's wealth, to allow superannuation funds money to buy out and get rid of every single cent of foreign debt, particularly publicly owned foreign debt in this country, so we're not beholden to foreign banks. Now, we could do that, internally mobilise that credit. That's something we could do tomorrow. But again, you're not going to see the huge mega profits that Macquarie Bank and others have been getting Macquarie Bank has one particular facility, I think it's premium funding, where they will charge you 10%, close to 10%, for the ability to fund your... They'll lend you the money to fund your insurance premium for a year on a business.
Absolutely. And we are going to break, or we'll continue with that shortly. And I've got a few questions I want to pose about some of the outcomes for Australia. Do stay with us.
My name is Stuart Smith from naturespureorganics.com, and I would like to invite you to come by our store at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite D, here in Austin, Texas, behind Brave New Books and Chase Bank, to see all our fantastic health and wellness products with your very own eyes. Have a look at our miracle healing clay that started our adventure in alternative medicine. Take a peek at some of our other wonderful products, including our Australian emu oil, lotion candles, olive oil soaps, and colloidal silver and gold. Call 512-264-4043 or find us online at naturespureorganics.com. That's 512-264-4043, naturespureorganics.com. Don't forget to like us on Facebook for information on events and our products. naturespureorganics.com.
Plaintiff or defendant in a lawsuit? Win your case without an attorney with Juris Dictionary, the affordable, easy to understand 4-CD course that will show you how in 24 hours, step by step. If you have a lawyer, know what your lawyer should be doing. If you don't have a lawyer, know what you should do for yourself. Thousands have won with our step-by-step course, and now you can too. Juris Dictionary was created by a licensed attorney with 22 years of case-winning experience. Even if you're not in a lawsuit, you can learn what everyone should understand about the principles and practices that control our American courts. You'll receive our audio classroom, video seminar, tutorials, forms for civil cases, pro se tactics, and much more. Please visit ruleoflawradio.com and click on the banner, or call toll-free 866-LAW.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And my guest today is Craig Isherwood. Craig, I've got a question about, well, it's sort of an observation, more a reflection to make about, I mean, we're talking a lot about sovereignty in this show, and we're talking about trying to regain our ownership of our country, of our resources, and to generate our own wealth. But it seems to me that there is a deliberate strategy on the part of the ruling oligarchy of this planet to basically erode our sovereignty, and that we are working against a very deliberate plan that they have put in place to eliminate our sovereignty. And one of the ways that they're doing it is, as I see, is this massive immigration into the country. Now, I'm not against having the country be open to people. You know, I'm certainly not against refugees. I'm not one of these people who says, oh, we should stop the refugee boats. I don't see refugees as being a huge influx of people. But I see the 300,000 or so coming in every year as a huge number, and it is a huge number, and this is being done under a deliberate plan. Now, why is this important? Because this huge influx of immigration does actually keep the economy bubbling over. I mean, it does, in a way, stimulate the economy, but it also completely erodes the natural, organic concept of what our nation is. I mean, all these people who are arriving in the country have no concept, really, of the nationhood, you know, of where they are and who they are. But, you know, it seems to me that the ideas that you're putting forward, which are very noble, and I agree with them, cannot work in a context where your country is just being flooded with people from all over the world who have really no concept of who we are as a nation.
That goes back to the basis of the fight that was in the late 19th century around the question of what Australia was going to be. Are we going to be the United States of Australia, on the US model of sovereignty and as a true sovereign republic where we govern our own affairs, or are we going to become part of the British Empire? Now, we were moving towards the United States of Australia. We were having a constitution that had the similar sorts of ideas embodied within it. Unfortunately, that constitution was taken to the Foreign Office or the Home Office in London, rewritten, and we ended up with a constitution that made us a self-governing colony of the British Empire. So we've never ever become autonomous. We've never become sovereign. Yeah. We've always become autonomous. We've always been up until even to the 50s, before we were given our, sorry, the 40s during the war, when we were given our right to prosecute the war under Curtin and Chifley for ourselves instead of being beholden to Britain to prosecute the war. We haven't been actually sovereign. Now, this means that, well, who is sovereign? Well, in our country, it's not the people who are sovereign. We've been given a parliamentary system whereby the parliamentary system itself is beholden to the financial powers and the financial oligarchy that is dictating the policies of our nation. And I don't know of any person within the parliament of our country that stands up for the principles of sovereignty independent of the existing prevailing ideologies of free trade and everything else that goes with this British monetarist system. So when you're talking about immigration, yes, we do need a lot more people in this country, but they have to be placed in into high-paying jobs so that they're not simply a burden on the economy, but they also have to come into a mission orientation about what this country represents.
Yeah.
And the hideous policy of what you see with the current coalition, particularly under the Abbott government, of locking up kids and asylum seekers in prisons, effectively.
Yeah.
What does that do? That's the message we're sending to people coming to Australia, is that our country doesn't care about you. You're a problem. You're not really human. You're just, you know, you're an economic problem to us because we've got to deal with you. Instead of having a top-down approach, we're saying, well, what are we as a nation going to represent for this region? How can we develop ourselves and at the same time develop other countries around us? You know, are we going to be completely beholden to a private banking system that demands $30 billion of profits from its citizens every year? Or are we going to actually have representatives of this country that stand for sovereignty, that place the banking system, which is out of control, in control, reintroduce the sorts of regulation necessary to guarantee the stability of the system, unlike what we saw in this country during the GFC period, or whatever. Now, these are huge questions, and at the moment we're finding a government that's too little to deal with them, and a government that's in position because of these private financial institution banks and so forth. They don't want to buck globalization and free trade. They're promoting it. They're promoting the TPP, which is smashing sovereignty. So we're heading into a difficult period whereby if these policies prevail, we're going to see more and more of these one-term governments. People are going to be very dissatisfied with the fact that their government doesn't represent them, but rather is more interested in representing policies that support large corporations and the banks. And we're also going to become more and more exposed to what's taking place overseas.
Can I just ask, I've just got one more question I want to get in. We haven't got much time left. I want to ask about bail-ins, because the last time we spoke, you had done your research and you were indicating that if there was another bank collapse in Australia, that we could be seeing bail-ins. There's been reports from the authorities in Australia who conducted an investigation into this, and I've just got an article up here from the Sydney Morning Herald from last year from David Murray, who was chair of a financial system inquiry, who said that bail-ins are inevitable for Australia. I mean, can you just repeat for our listeners what the bail-in is and what it really means and how likely it is that we're going to see this?
Okay, well, we've already seen it in our country, in New South Wales, in the 1890s. They actually bailed in the banks back then where the depositors weren't able to get their money.
Right.
And the banks at that point said, oh, we're going to convert your deposits into shares. And they did. They converted them into preference shares and all sorts of different things where the people actually never saw most of their money. Now, bail-in is literally that, where they say they take the depositors' funds, which is a liability to the banks, and they say, oh, well, we can't pay you, therefore we're going to make you a shareholder. And that moves the liability into capital, which means that there's no longer a liability. Here in Australia, we created an enormous stink about this going back into 2013. We published an ad in The Australian saying no to bail-in, and every time we had our members contact Joe Hockey, he was hysterical about the fact, no, there's never going to be any bail-in in Australia. Mm-hmm. Yet you have Murray, as you say, come out saying it's going to be inevitable. Well, it's already happened in part, but through the back door. And that is that they've created these instruments now called bail-inable bonds. Now, bail-inable bonds are issued by banks, and they're basically going to get written off if there's ever a problem with the banking system. It's basically cancelled. Now, these bail-inable bonds aren't going to be bought by you and me because we can't get access to them, but they are going to be bought by your superannuation funds. They're going to be sold to the superannuation funds. So your superannuation that you may not pay very much attention to may be invested in these bail-inable bonds, which are growing every single week, more and more of them being issued.
Wow.
So therefore, your superannuation goes into these bail-inable bonds. If there's a problem with the bank, then the bank says, oh, we can't do anything, we write these bonds off, then you lose your superannuation. So mum and dads that aren't paying attention to their super find that they've just lost their money through the same process that they couldn't overtly get away with, like literally sealing your deposits.
Yes.
But you've gone through the back door. So that process is actually taking place now. That's part of Australian law is happening. So, yes, we've got bail-in of that form. And I suspect over the next several years that's going to become more and more and more of the way the banks operate. They're going to issue more and more bail-inable securities.
Can I just ask, what is the advantage of a bail-inable bond? Does it provide a higher yield? What would make an investor want to buy a bail-inable bond?
Yeah, it will make a higher yield. They'll issue it at a higher interest rate.
Yeah.
Right. Not much higher, but the risk is then borne by the investor more than by the bank, because when the bank gets into trouble for them, just ta-da, sorry, can't do it, you signed this. You know, we legally can say we don't have to pay this back because it's a bail-inable bond, and that solves the problem. Pretty hideous, but that's another way that they're basically getting at the deposits of mum and dad investors through the superannuation.
Gee, isn't that? That's just really despicable, isn't it? And it really highlights something about superannuation, which I've always felt, is that it was actually a money grab on the part of the government, but it was never understood to be that, because people always thought, well, that's my money, it's just I can't get it yet, right? But
it's a bailout for the banking system.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of superannuation, where the government mandates that you have to hand over 15% of your income to be sort of out of your grasp until a certain age, you know, we needed to recognise when that was brought in. When was that? 1991 or something? Was that under Keating?
96, I think.
Was 96. 96, right? Was that under Keating or Howard?
No, it's Keating's baby. He was. It's only at I think what, 9.25% at the moment, or 9.5%, 9.25%. But the point is that he wants it to go to 15%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now that's a huge impost on small businesses.
Oh yeah, it's
a huge amount of money for them to have to find all the time. And it was a trade-off for wage rises and so forth. So what you're doing, instead of having that money in the hands of people that can choose to do what they want, and the money gets locked up and simply gets locked up in the banking system. So the banking system has $1 trillion that's keeping it functional, or trying to keep it functional.
That's right. And so now we are moving into a situation where, I mean, this money now represents a huge part of the money in the economy.
That's right, huge. But it's not mobilised in the right way. It's in speculative instruments. If that money were to be mobilised into building large-scale infrastructure projects, like I said before, take a maglev train, have a huge network to break the tyranny of distance down in this country, and then develop the secondary industries like the building of the rolling stock, the steel mills, the concrete, the whole works.
Craig, we are at the end of the hour. I'm so sorry to have to cut you off. It's been absolutely awesome talking to you, and thank you so much. It's a real help having you on.
Thanks, thanks, Harold. We'll do it again sometime.
Yeah, terrific. That's Truth News Radio Australia signing out for this week. We'll be back next week. See you then, folks.
Like to make more definite progress in your walk with God? Bibles for America is offering a free study Bible and a set of free Christian books that can really help. The New Testament Recovery Version is one of the most comprehensive study Bibles available today. It's an accurate translation, and it contains thousands of footnotes that will help you to know God and to know the meaning of life. The free books are a three-volume set called Basic Elements of the Christian Life. Chapter by chapter, Basic Elements of the Christian Life clearly presents God's plan of salvation, growing in Christ, and how to build up the church. To order your free New Testament Recovery Version and Basic Elements of the Christian Life, call Bibles for America toll-free at 888-551-0102. That's 888-551-0102. Or visit us online at bfa.org.
Looking for some truth? You found it. LogosRadioNetwork.com.